Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Under the Hoodies. This is Bill Cagle. I'm joined by Brian Shipley. Brian, can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can. What's going on, Bill?
Oh, not much, man, not much. Hey, I'm calling you from using my wife's phone today. My phone is being preoccupied, and I'm not hearing very well out of this phone. So I've been trying to get a hold of you, man. But anyway, we're gonna try to forge on with the show. So how's it going, Brian? How's it been? How you been since the last time I saw you?
I've been doing pretty well. How about you, buddy? How's the new job going?
Oh, the new job is very, very physically demanding. It's like being in the NFL, but I'm paid a lot less. But you know what? It's a pay raise, so no complaints.
Well, at least you don't have the whole concussion-y thing to worry about, so that's good.
That's a very fair point. It's a very fair point. As long as I don't drop any water bottles on me, I think I'm okay. So again, we're Mike Possessulous today. I'm a little devastated about again, same thing that's been going on. It's been going on for a long time, Brian. So let's just wish him a speedy solution to his current plight.
No doubt about it. Yeah, I talked to him earlier to see if he'd be on, and you know, he said unfortunately now, which is too bad because I was looking forward to hearing his thoughts on the NBA draft, and you know, I know he was very fond of Tony Gwynn, which we're going to touch on later. So we'll certainly miss you tonight, Mike.
Right. So, yeah, let's just dive into it, Brian, because unfortunately I'm a little limited on time, and I have to apologize. I'll have to talk to you about it off air. But if you read my Facebook status yesterday, I think you might understand. I very rarely get like that, but it's hard time of the year for me. So anyway, we're going to move to a lot less tragic ground, for lack of a better term. And maybe it is equally as tragic. We're going to talk about the NBA Finals. And, God, it just didn't look like it was fair from the beginning. I mean, Spurs passed the ball 100-plus more times a game, more assists. I mean, they ran the floor. I mean, they calculated miles, total team miles, and the Spurs, and I believe game four, ran a mile further than the Heat, which lets me know that they're moving the ball and they're moving around and the Heat were not. So what'd you take away from the finals?
Yeah, that was a heck of a prediction, Bill. I know I was predicting the Spurs the last time we talked, I predicted the Heat the last time we talked, and you were pretty confident that the Spurs were the better team, which I think they clearly showed. I really went with the Heat just because, I mean, LeBron is just amazing, and he played amazing throughout the finals. He was so good. But I think what we saw is that when you play team basketball, when you share the basketball, you know, there's no one person quick enough to outrun the speed of good passing. And whereas we see the teams that the Heat match up really well with are teams that have one predominant scorer that they can just stick LeBron on, sort of like we saw with Lance Stephenson when he was getting hot in the Indiana series, or, you know, a few years ago when they played the Knicks in the playoffs, they stuck LeBron on Carmelo, and everybody else didn't know what the heck to do out there. Well, you know, in this instance, you have the best defensive weapon in the NBA, in my opinion, on LeBron, even though all his, you know, offensive prowess gets all the publicity. But who do you put him on? I mean, you can't put him on – you put him on one person, that's fine. They're just going to pass it to the open guy for, an open three or a free layup or whatever. So I thought that really took away one of Miami's best assets. And other than that, we just saw one team that was playing on almost like the turbo level in the old school NBA Jam video games, whereas the Heat were not on that turbo level. And it just looked like both teams were playing at different speeds.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it just looked like everybody but LeBron and the Heat just did not want to be there. Like, Wade looked terrible. Bosh didn't look good at all. None of the regulars, if we can call them, that, Mario Chalmers, Norris Cole, Birdman, none of them really showed up. And it's kind of sad to see because we saw LeBron do exactly what LeBron does, and unfortunately he's probably going to get the brunt of this of the abuse, but it really wasn't him. It really was not. He played exactly how he played every game, and just nobody else around him stepped up. So, I don't know. I think the NBA Finals has kind of been beat up a little bit, but we definitely should give our opinions on it. So we're going to jump right into the upcoming LeBron James sweepstakes. Now, I've been reading, you know, the Clippers could be a possible landing spot, going back to Cleveland, staying with Miami, you know, and maybe there's another team out there that, you know, that has the space to sign a guy, like a guy to a max contract. So where do you see LeBron, what do you see LeBron doing as far as his next team?
Well, you know, that answer is what every single scribe and reporter and beat reporter and analyst in the NBA is just trying to figure out right now as we speak. I really don't know. I have no clue. If I had a guess and put money down on something, it would be for him to return to Miami at least for one more season. And, you know, if the team continues to seemingly spiral downhill, then he can always get out then and maybe give the Cavaliers a chance to show with a number one pick that they're headed in the right spot. But right now I think he's going to Miami.
This is their third try at showing that, and they haven't done it yet. So
no, they haven't done it yet. But, you know, this seems to be a draft where you could take one of five or six guys and at least get a solid starter, which we'll talk more about later. But I'm not a big, I'm not one of these people that overanalyzes players' body language or how they interact on the floor. You know, I like to look at more tangible things. But I'll tell you right now, the way just LeBron and Wade interacted during the postseason, and especially in the finals, you know, it felt like that couple that everybody, you know, they keep telling you everything's all right and they're so happy together and this and that, and then a month later you find out they're filing for divorce. And you can just see that, you know, maybe both of them wanted to work out, but for whatever reason it wasn't. And, I mean, Dwayne Wade just did not look happy all postseason. You know, LeBron's facial expressions reminded me back of the Cleveland Cavalier days where it's like, you know, is anybody going to help me out here? I mean, what's going on? So I'm not going to be surprised at all if he leaves. But I just can't imagine him playing for the Clippers. I can't imagine him in New York. You know, I think it's a two-team race. If he leaves Miami, I think it would only be to return home to Cleveland. I just don't really see what else makes sense as far as from a narrative perspective. I mean, certainly there's other teams that make more sense as far as trying to get to the titles, but I just don't think it makes sense for him and his quote-unquote legacy to go to any place other than Cleveland if he's going to leave Miami.
No, I agree with you, and I will say that if he does go to the Lakers, I am done with the NBA until LeBron retires to the Lakers fold, and since I don't see the Lakers are folding, obviously, I will be done with the NBA for quite some time if that happens. I will be disgusted and upset, and I can't even begin to describe the rage I feel right now just talking about it. So let's just hope that doesn't happen. So, the only real rumors I've heard are returning to Miami, him going to Cleveland, and then somebody floated the Clippers out semi-recently. Now, I don't think at this point LeBron even knows what he wants to do. I think that he's doing exactly what he says. He's going on vacation, and then he'll figure it out when he comes back, which I think that that's what he'll do. And let's just hope there's not the kind of backlash there was after the decision, which actually ended up benefiting a lot of young children in the Hartford, Connecticut, which apparently has a really, really bad part of it. And apparently LeBron's decision bought them a whole new facility and a bunch of computers, and a bunch of kids' lives got a little bit better because of that. So, you know, let's maybe not, you know, look back on that and kill LeBron like we did when it first happened.
Yeah, well said. Well said.
So,
where do you think Bosh and Wade end up, though? Do you think they're both pretty much locks to stay in Miami?
I agree with you 100%. I don't see Dwayne Wade ever leaving Miami. I mean, I think he's to Miami what Magic Johnson is to the Lakers. I just don't see him. I think he's, I mean, LeBron excluded because he didn't play his whole career there. I think Dwayne Wade is the single greatest Miami Heat player of all time, and I think that Pat Riley is a fan of those kind of legacy players and will keep and do everything in his power to keep Wade there, and I don't think it really is going to take much. I think Wade's going to retire Heat. So
I would say that Alonzo Mourning might bench press you with some of those statements, but we'll leave that for another day.
No, I think Dwayne Wade's probably a better player than Alonzo. I think Wade got a chip by him.
I'm just saying that that Zoe's kind of Mr. Miami right now, as evidenced by him getting the seat next to Pat Riley and whatnot. But no,
no,
you're
agree.
Right. He is Mr. NBA, and no one's paying him what he's going to make next year on the free agent market anyway. So it really makes sense for both sides to continue that marriage.
Right, absolutely. And Chris Bosh, I mean, he could opt out and go anywhere, I guess, but I don't really see him leaving Miami either. So the other big free agent we should talk about, you and I will defend this guy to our death, is one Mr. Carmelo Anthony. Now, a lot of rumors about him going to Houston. That seems to be the big destination for him. And I think if I read right, if they get rid of – if they let Lin go and for whatever reason, I'm drawing a blank on the other – oh, excuse me, Asik. Omar Asik. If they get rid of those two, they have enough space to sign Melo. Obviously, they go over the soft cap and have to pay the luxury tax, but there hasn't been a team that's won the finals since the luxury cap's inception that hasn't paid the luxury cap – or, excuse me, luxury tax. So that's not – I don't think that's really an issue. So I think that's where he's going to go. Unfortunately for me as a Knicks fan, I think he's going to go to Houston. And, boy, you want to talk about no defense getting played. Whew, boy, if that happens, then we're in for a lot of high-scoring games, we'll put it like that.
Yeah, I kind of hate that fit for Carmelo. And, I mean, if him and James Harden are going to be on the same team, they better hope that the NBA passes a rule that you're allowed to use two basketballs on offense at once, because I just don't really see how that's going to work out. I really don't like the Rockets as far as just watching their style of play last year, the way they folded up in the first round on defense when the going got tough, their defense went going. I mean, I think James Harden's the worst defender in the NBA. And, you know, as much as we pick on Dwight Howard, he can still be a decent rim protector, but no one's going to be able to cover up that many mistakes. So the team that I still feel like is the best fit for Carmelo is the Chicago Bulls. I think that a healthy Derrick Rose, you know, Jakeem Noah has developed into one of the best players in the NBA, especially at the defensive end of the floor, and someone that's going to be able to rebound the basketball, get some second-chance opportunities for Carmelo. I still think that's his best bet to go, but, you know, I guess it remains to be seen, but I would love to see the Bulls make a run at him, and I'd love to see him go there instead of with the Rockets, where, you know, I don't think it's a good fit, and B, why would you not want to stay in the East and try to get another super team when, you know, it's basically a cakewalk to the conference finals, and all you have to do is beat the Heat. So I think that's as easy as road to a championship, and I would personally be trying to, if I was Handler and his agent, if you're winning the championship's your number one thing, I'm going to say, well, let's stay in the East and find the best fit for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're 100% right. I mean, especially if Tom Thibodeau is there next year, which they, you know, earlier, middle of the season, there was rumors that he might not be there next year, but haven't heard much since. But, yeah, especially if he's there with that defense. I mean, Melo can focus on the other end of the floor because they play such great defense. And, I mean, you have one of the biggest, papering over some weaknesses on defense. You have one of the best guys in the league to do it, which is Noah. So, I mean, I think it really would be in Carmelo's best interest if he's trying to get a title to go to Chicago. And I think going to Chicago, I don't think a lot of people would kind of blame him for, quote-unquote, chasing a title by going to Chicago, because he's automatically going to be the guy. I mean, Derrick Rose hasn't played meaningful basketball in 2 years. And, I mean, it's going to take a while for him to get going, and I think he's going to take probably a good chunk of the season. I mean, I really think the season is going to be used, if he does stay healthy next year, to get him ready for the playoffs, you know, to get his legs back under him. That's all contingent on the if. And I think Melo's going to carry the team. Melo's been super durable. I don't know. I would love to see it. I mean, as a Knicks fan, it would stink, but at the same time, you know, what is that office doing to put a team around him? I mean, not much. So I don't know
right.
How Derek Fisher's going to be as a head coach. I don't like this NBA player to head coach thing that's going on right now with Jason Kidd, you know, doing it in Brooklyn. And everyone will say, oh, it worked out. He made it to the playoffs. But it's like, it was the weakest conference that I can recall in all sports, let alone the NBA. I mean, I don't really think any team anybody that could have coached that team would have at least gotten him a 5 seed. So I don't know. I think if the Bulls had Carmelo this year, I think they easily get to the conference finals against Miami. I mean, I don't think it's close. I mean, they played their hearts out, and the only thing they were really lacking was a scorer, and because obviously their scorer has been out for 2 seasons. So I 100% agree with you. I think that's where he should go, and I would really like to see him in a Bulls uniform.
Yeah, I would like that too, and I don't even think it's plausible unless they really made some moves to open up cap space. But and if he does go out west, there's always been one player that I've always thought that he would just fit in so well with that they could get on the same team. And not too long ago, it didn't seem like that far-fetched scenario based upon reports of his toast at Carmelo Anthony's wedding, and that is Chris Paul. I just always felt those two would really, really play well together. And, you know, if the Clippers could somehow manage it, and I think that would be an interesting fit as well, because we saw them really struggle on offense at times, at least in the half-court offense in the playoffs. And, you know, I don't think there's a better half-court scorer in the NBA than Carmelo right now, other than Kevin Durant. So I think that could be an interesting fit for him. But, you know, ultimately I really do not want to see him in the Rockets uniform, because I'm not a big James Harden fan, and nor am I a Dwight Howard fan. And I don't think Kevin McHale is going to maximize the talent of that roster. I don't have much confidence in that either. So I hope he stays away from there. And, you know, the thing I think people forget and don't really talk much about is these guys can take a wait-and-see approach with their current teams too, give them kind of a year to, you know, sort of a feeling-out year where it wouldn't be such a, you know, a quick change. And LeBron, Carmelo, both can become free agents after next season, give their teams one more shot, you know, show that Pat Riley, in his words, can retool the roster to, you know, make them as good as the top teams out west, and give Phil Jackson a chance and Derek Fisher a chance to show Carmelo that we can build a contender around you before you're too old. So I wouldn't be surprised, especially LeBron, if you stay for one more year, but, you know, I think Carmelo really has one foot out the door, and I don't blame him whatsoever for it.
No, I agree with you. I agree with everything you just said. I mean, it's not good radio, but everything you're saying makes a ton of sense to me. I mean, I would love – I have a question for you, actually. I just thought of this. Would – if you are – you know, if you're the general manager of the Clippers, do you – would you trade Blake Griffin for Carmelo at this stage in both of their careers straight up? And I think this is a pretty easy answer, probably for both of us.
Absolutely. In a heartbeat, man. I mean – I know he made some strides this year, but I've always felt like Blake Griffin's been one of the most overrated players in the NBA, and if it wasn't for his, you know, awesome dunks, I don't think he would be considered a quote-unquote superstar, franchise player, whatever. And, I mean, you can't play him on the floor late in games. His defense is suspect at best. So if you're going to have a guy that really can't play late in games and has suspect defense, you might as well trade him for a guy that play suspect defense, but at least can put the, you know, the ball in the hole and get you a bunch of points and be a closer late in games and take the big shots late in games. So I would certainly do that, even though, you know, when you factor in age and whatnot, I can see, you know, a strong case against it. But that's what I would do, because I really think that Chris Paul and Carmelo on the same team could be lethal. But what about you? Would you make that trade?
Oh yeah, in a heartbeat. It's not even close. Like, I think that it comes down to this. They're actually kind of similar. They're actually kind of similar body types, even though they don't play a lot of. I don't play similar. Like, I mean, Melo's a he can actually score. People don't give Carmelo enough credit for his back to the basket game. He's actually pretty good as a four. I actually think he might be a better four than Blake Griffin, which is Blake's natural position, where Carmelo's naturally a three. But yeah, I don't think it's close. I mean, would you feel comfortable with Blake Griffin taking a 15-footer or Carmelo shooting a three to win you a game? I mean,
right.
It's not even close. Like, I would, and I only thought of it because I don't know the Clippers cap situation. I actually should have looked this up before the show, but I do wonder if they could acquire Melo. I mean, if there's rumors that they can acquire LeBron, I'm not even sure. Carmelo, I don't know if he'd be germane to taking a pay cut, but I'm not, like I said, I should have looked at numbers before the show, and I will have this next week. I don't see why that's not being made a bigger deal, because you're right, Chris Paul and Carmelo together, God, Chris Paul was not a fan of Blake Griffin doing always looking for the alley-oop for the fast break and all that. Chris Paul's a half-court guy. He likes to manage the offense. He's not a quote unquote gunslinger. Like, he's not Jason Kidd, you know, with those really fun to watch Nets teams. Like, Chris Paul's a very, very methodical guy. He's the smartest point guard in the league. I think that pairing him with Carmelo, God, that'd be deadly. I'm actually getting kind of happy thinking about that. That is a very slim possibility to get to watch that next year. That would actually deter me from being devastated if LeBron were to go to the Lakers and Carmelo were to go to the Clippers. I would actually, those two would offset each other, and I would just go back to watching the NBA again. So, you know what, let's hope that happens, because as much as I like the Knicks, I love good basketball, and that would just be a beautiful thing to watch.
Yeah, that would be awesome. You made a good point about, you know, possibly sliding Carmelo in at the four, and that's why I've heard some people think, you know, how can you put LeBron and Carmelo on the same team since they both play the same position, which is true. But, I mean, if you want to go with the ridiculous small ball lineup that's just super athletic and impossible to match up with on the offensive end, I think Carmelo can, at least for long stretches of every game, be an outstanding small ball four. So that's certainly a fit, and I think that Carmelo's really going to have a lot more suitors than people think, because I know the narrative on him is that, oh, he's selfish, doesn't do enough to help win the, win games for his teams or carry his team on the back, blah, blah, blah. And I just think that's all BS. I mean, he won a championship at college. If you watched any Knicks game last year, I mean, they were just horrible. And, yeah, he took a lot of shots, because every time the shot clock got under 10 seconds, whoever else had the ball would just throw it to him because they couldn't create on their own. So I think putting Carmelo in a winning environment, you're really going to see him shine. And really, I think he can be, if not the number one guy in a championship team, a 1B or a solid number two. So,
yeah, we'll, and I think the people that
think summer, to say the least.
Yeah, I think the people that that say that about Carmelo are people that are A, on TV looking to get ratings, and B, people that don't watch Carmelo play basketball, but watch those guys. I'm in the media to talk about it, because anybody that watches Carmelo knows that guy leaves it all on the floor. Like, I mean, he can be a little lackadaisical on defense, but that guy, I don't know. He would be one of my top three picks if I was starting an NBA franchise, and I can have anybody in the league at the age of 25. I feel like Carmelo, worst-case scenario, would be in my top five. I mean, top three, it would be hard to argue against Durant, LeBron, and Chris Paul, but, I mean, I think Carmelo's in the discussion of that tier two, you know, guys who would start a franchise with, if you could have any player in the league at, you know, age 23 to 25. So, yeah, I've always disagreed with that notion that he's a selfish player. I mean, you and I watched him at Syracuse religiously. Like, he won a title. He didn't. He deferred. He was everything to that team.
Absolutely, and he went to the conference finals when the Lakers were in their heyday. And they had them on the ropes the one year. And when he was surrounded with other good players, such as, you know, Chauncey Billups still in his prime, Allen Iverson towards the end of his prime, Kenyon Martin, et cetera, et cetera, you know, he had no problem playing team ball and letting Chauncey run things and just be the scorer. And, you know, they were a break here, a break two away from going to the NBA Finals, and then all this silly narrative talk when it really have much legs, but of course, you know, no one wants to remember those days, so what are you going to do?
Right. I'm sorry about that, but you semi cut out on me a little bit, not your fault. It's definitely this fault. I told you I was having issues before the show. But anyway, I'm a little scatterbrained right now. Let's go ahead and switch topic here. NFL rookies. Who do you see? And you're the guy, Brian. You're the guy. You know all these players. You know, who do you see that was sort of a we're not going to go with the very easy Sammy Watkins or even Bishop Sankey, you know, any of those guys. Who's the guy that you see that's a you know, middle, not necessarily late round, but I'll say second to fourth round guy that you think can make a huge impact? Year one.
Huge impact year one. That's a That's an interesting question, and I think I'm going to go with, you know, this guy isn't really under the radar since he's a top 10 pick, but he hasn't been getting much publicity, and that's Eric Ebron, the tight end from North Carolina, who was taken 10th overall by the Detroit Lions. And, I mean, if you're a tight end, what a dream scenario to go where you have Calvin Johnson and taking so much attention on the outside. You have, you know, a prolific receiver out of the backfield, and Reggie Bush taking, you know, linebackers' attention. They signed Golden Tate to give him a solid number two receiver finally to pair with Calvin Johnson. And, I mean, I think the guy's just going to be a matchup nightmare over the middle on third downs. And I'm not sure if he'll have a huge season yardage-wise, but I think that guy's going to have 10-plus touchdowns this year simply because, you know, it's going to be impossible to double-team him and Calvin in the red zone. And he's the type of guy that you can just throw it up and let him go get it, sort of like a Jimmy Graham or a Rob Gronkowski in the red zone. So I think he's really gonna have a terrific season. They brought over Lombardi, who was an assistant under Sean Payton. It's actually Vince Lombardi's grandson, and he's bringing over that New Orleans Saints offense. And I think we've seen how they're able to utilize a tight end in that scheme. And I mean, if I was him, I would be just absolutely giddy over being picked by him. You know, he's a superb athlete, had a real nice combine, had a real nice college career for an underachieving program. And, you know, I say watch out for him and really watch out for the Lions. I would not be surprised at all if they were a legitimate playoff contender, and I could certainly see them go 10-6 or 11-5 next year, especially if they get the type of production I think they can from Ebron.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a good one because, you know, I really like Matt Stafford with a tight end. Because Matt Stafford, I mean, to me, the jury's still semi-sort of out on him because I think that he's a guy that sort of semi-kind of relies on Calvin Johnson. And, you know, what quarterback wouldn't? Because, I mean, if you think about it, he's the best, I mean, physical specimen in, you know, NFL history. I mean, you take a guy that size, you know, that ability, his leaping ability, his speed, you know, everything. He has everything. I mean, if you're crafting a, you know, it's already been said. If you're crafting a receiver, and you want him to look like Calvin Johnson. So it'll be interesting to see what Matt Stafford does with some weapons. I don't know if he'll know what to do right away just because, you know, he hasn't had them. I mean, at least nothing, you know, nothing quite like what Ebron's advertised. You know, somebody like Golden Tate is probably the second-best receiver I think Stafford's had. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. I can't think of anybody else. And we're not going to say Roy Williams because, you know, if my memory serves me, he might have left in Stafford's first year, his rookie year, second year, one of those years where Stafford was hurt. But anyway, another player that I was sort of thinking of that you know could be at least semi sort of interesting I remember the other thing I was going to ask you. And before I get into this, because I got to semi sort of regroup here, what do you think about this this talk about? Goodness, I apologize, Brian. Hold on. All right, I apologize about that, Brian.
No problem.
All right, so this is what I was trying to get at. Christine Michael, he's been a buzz all over Roto World is a guy to watch, a guy to draft in your dynasty league. You know, a guy that could be a late round steal, which I don't think that's even possible now because I've heard so much about him of late. Do you think he's going to unseat Marshawn Lynch this year? I've read a little bit. I mean, you were high on him last year. I mean, you had a funny quote. I think I might have mentioned this on the show. Was he makes Marshawn Lynch look like he went to Harvard. But what do you think? Do you think that this guy is ready to explode? Do you like any of the Adrian Peterson comparisons that I'm reading about?
Well, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I was the truck driver of the Christian Michael bandwagon, but I think anybody that's comparing him to Adrian Peterson needs to, you know, chime it down a little bit. He's not Adrian Peterson. I think he's a terrific prospect and an explosive-looking back who, you know, he's the type of guy that anytime he touches the ball, he can go for a big run, but he's also a physical runner that's going to help wear down defenses and, you know, seems to have the build and the stamina if he's in shape to be the type of guy that you can get the ball to 20-plus times a game. You know, as far as him unseating Marshawn Lynch, as much as I dislike Marshawn Lynch for an array of reasons, I think that it's hard to argue that he was anything other than stellar again last season for the Seahawks. You know, that said, I still find Marshawn Lynch to be sort of that 4 yards in a cloud of dust type of running back, whereas, you know, Michael can give you something a little bit more dynamic. You know, he's the type of guy that's going to offer more out of the backfield as a receiver than Marshawn Lynch. And I think you can make a good argument that if you want the Seahawks offense to evolve from more than just ball control, don't turn the ball over, you know, run the ball, grind it out type of offense, you might have to give a guy like Michael that can break a big play open and do a little bit more in the receiving game, more opportunities. But I think that his time to shine is going to be 2015, more so than 2014, unless Marshawn Lynch's play, you know, sort of falls off a cliff, which is not all that unheard of for a running back that's had as many carries for him. I mean, you never really know when that cliff's going to happen for him. So I could certainly see that happening. But if I had to bet money on it, I would bet that Marshawn Lynch still has about 280 to 300 carries, assuming he stays healthy this year, which to me means Christian Michael will be a 4 to 7 touch-a-game guy unless Marshawn Lynch gets hurt. I think this will be the year they get his feet wet, 2015. I could see him move on from Lynch, and that's going to be his time to shine.
Gotcha. And then another guy that I actually am kind of excited about, and I'm curious your thoughts on him as a breakout rookie guy, is Andre Williams, the Giants' fourth-round pick. Do you like him with that offensive line, in that offense, the Ben McAdoo offense, the guy that came from Green Bay? And the Giants have some weapons. I mean, they have Reuben Randall, who has, you know, rocks for brains, but, you know, he made some pretty spectacular catches, you know, because of Eli's sort of erratic arm last year. You know, Jarrell Jernigan, you and I like him a lot. Obviously, you know, we're going to get from Victor Cruz. Andre Williams, I mean, do you see him in a breakout role this year?
Honestly, I don't. And unfortunately, you know, I hate to say that to you, but that was not a pick I really liked. I thought he was more of a 6th, 7th round, maybe even undrafted type running back. You know, let me preface that by saying this guy is as hard and diligent a worker and overachiever, and he does have some talent. I mean, he's impossible not to root for, and those type of guys often find ways to overcome their deficiencies to be, you know, at least contributors. But let me explain why I don't think he's going to make too much of an impact for him. While at Boston College, he had 0 receptions last season, despite being a Heisman Trophy finalist, which shows, you know, he's not a versatile skill set. He's not the type of guy that is going to help your offense in a variety of ways. He's going to be a first and second down thumper. And if I'm a defense, I'm not even worried about him coming in and worried about him hurting us in the flats or, you know, on a screen game or anything like that. The combine, I know some people can think it's overrated, but one of the best parts about it is you can really see guys that can naturally catch the hands and guys that look like they've never done it before. And when they threw him the football, it looked like they were throwing him a 30-pound rock the way he was reaching out for it. So both those things worry me. And then other than that, I just don't think he has an elite running back skill set that you would expect from a guy that's going to break out and take the NFL by storm. That's not to say he can't become a competent back. I mean, we've seen the Reuben Drones of the world. You know, we've seen even a guy like Alfred Morris, who I do like a lot. But, I mean, you know, he doesn't have any real distinguishing features other than the fact that he runs hard and he's a smart player. So at the very least, I think, you know, perhaps he could turn into a guy like that, but I'm certainly not betting on it. And as far as I'm concerned, at this point in time, I think Rashad Jennings is a far superior player. And if I'm the coach of the Giants or the offensive coordinator, I'm simply not bringing Rashad Jennings off the field unless he needs a breather to bring in Andre Williams. So I don't think he's a real threat to Jennings' snap count. And if David Wilson can ever get cleared and ever get healthy, as far as I'm concerned, Andre Williams better get in tight with the special teams coach because that means he's the third best back on the roster.
Yeah, I was hoping that's what you would not say, but yeah, by all accounts, you're right. As depressing as it is for me to listen to that, you're right. And you know what, David Wilson, Tom Coughlin brought my favorite team 2 titles. All right, 2 Super Bowls. Everybody knows the stories. But God, I cannot think of a player that he mishandled more than David Wilson. Pulling him in that game. In that first game of the year, because he fumbled, Adrian Peterson cost his team chance of the Super Bowl against the Saints in the NFC Championship because of a fumble. It's ridiculous. Exactly. Like he was, Adrian Peterson was one of the worst running backs in the league at ball security for years, and you know what? He's probably going to go down as one of the 3 greatest running backs of all time. I mean, these things can be fixed. Look at the other Giants running back, Tiki Barber. These things are fixable, and I think eroding his confidence like that, man, really hurt him. And then the whole neck thing, I'm hoping he bounce back because that guy is one of the 5 to 10 most explosive players in the NFL. Like, incredible ability. He would have been the only exciting part of the Giants. Otherwise, boring offense last year. So I asked about Andre Williams out of a sheer shred of hope that the Giants hopefully can, I guess, sort of recapture what I thought David Wilson was going to give us. So,
and that's kind of an interesting look at 2 of them, because Andre Williams will probably rarely, if ever, fumble. It's an interesting comparison of what type of running back you'd rather have. It's sort of the Andre Williams, Ben Jarvis Green Ellis type running back that is not going to fumble. It's always going to know their assignment, et cetera, et cetera. But as far as I'm concerned, I'd much rather have the David Wilsons of the world, at least when healthy, who, they might fumble, they might make some mistakes, but to use a different sport analogy, can you out-hit your mistakes? It's like a slugging left fielder that's going to hit you 35 bombs, draw a bunch of walks, and just make major play after play on offense. But he also might lose a fly ball in the sun. He might take a bad pass to the ball. He might dive for a ball and it goes over his head. He might miss the throw to second. And, of course, you wish he was better at defense. But at the end of the day, can you out-hit your mistakes? And I'll take a few blunders out in the outfield in exchange for that prodigious offensive production in baseball. Just as in the NFL, I'll take 5 to 7 fumbles and maybe a missed assignment or 2 here and there, and then keep patting his back, telling him just keep doing what you do, and trade that up for David Wilson breaking 3 50-plus-yard runs to the house, or making a couple guys miss on a screen on a 3rd and 12. I think those things, as long as you can do them consistently, like a guy like Wilson can, in the long run, I think you still come up with a net positive if you don't make such a big deal about his fumbling like Tom Coughlin did.
Right, and I just think, I don't know if mentally he was going to recover at all last year, and then the whole neck injury thing, sort of a freak thing, too. It just kind of stinks for a guy that with that kind of ability. But let's, as a Giants fan, I promise I'm not going to keep bringing up the Giants every week, especially during the season. I might bring him up, for a very small portion of the season, and it would only be fair that once we get Mike back and we get him a new favorite NFL team, and we start talking Giants, Broncos, and my money is Mike, by the way. Once we get back to a routine here with us three, I think he's gonna end up either a Steelers or a Bills fan. So we'll make sure we shoehorn both those teams in too. So anyway, we're going to switch gears and talk a little baseball. Clayton Kershaw, is he the best pitcher in the league?
Oh, yeah, hands down. I think, lefty with a nasty fastball, nasty curveball, gets a lot of strikeouts. And for the first time ever this year, he had a DL stint. But other than that, you can pencil him in for 200-plus innings a year. And I think without question he's the best starter in baseball right now. But as we see with so many pitcher injuries, that can quickly change. But until he has a serious arm injury, I think it's his title to lose.
Do you think Felix Hernandez has anything to say about your best pitcher in the league opinion?
Yeah, I'm sure he does, but you know, as great as King Felix is, I mean, there's just so few lefties that can throw 95 miles an hour like that. Like, you just don't see guys like that. So I just feel like what Kershaw has is unique, whereas as great as Felix Hernandez is, I do think there's other guys a little bit more comparable with them, whereas I think Kershaw is just in a class on his own and, you know, just has terrific command of the strike zone, nasty breaking ball, and then, of course, the aforementioned fastball, which, you know, I think the breaking pitches was really sets him apart from Hernandez, though.
All right. Anything else in baseball you want to talk about? I mean, I have to be honest, you know, with the new job and a lot of birthdays, every female I know, my wife, my sister-in-law, my sisters, all have birthdays this month, and I've been, you know, going back and forth. You know, you and I have a mutual friend that lost somebody very close to them recently. I mean, just I have been semi-out on baseball, and I have to apologize for you and the listeners and everybody. What else do you want to talk about when it comes to the baseball? Any topics you got other than Tony Gwynn? We're going to finish the show with Tony Gwynn.
You know, I think that before we get to Gwynn, that I think it's going to be a really interesting trade deadline season. Thanks to the second wild card and then just general parity in the game right now, there's really no, other than a handful of teams, there's really no team that's quote unquote out of the race yet. So I think you're going to see a lot of GMs, a lot of owners, a lot of front offices, a lot of teams that want their teams to make move to try to get that second wild card, which is to me sort of like fool's gold because, A, you're competing with so many other teams for it, then unless you really believe in your talent, I think it's kind of foolish to go all in just to try to get the second wild card because, you know, many of the advantages of making the playoffs where, you know, the baseball playoffs are the definition of a crapshoot where if your team gets hot at the right time, anything can happen. But in order to get into the postseason through that second wild card, you have to win one play-in game. And even if you're going with the 1927 Yankees versus the 2012 Florida Marlins, Miami Marlins, I mean, no matter how much better one team is than the other, they're still only about a 55 to 45% favorite. So although I think it's silly to chase after that, I do think a bunch of teams will, especially teams that have been starving for a postseason berth. You know, I'm thinking about the Kansas City Royals, who are actually now in first place in the AL Central. You know, I think this is their year where they made a big trade for James Shields 2 years ago. This is the last year of his deal before he becomes a free agent. They're unlikely to sign him. I mean, you got to maximize that trade that you made where you gave up, you know, a couple of real nice young assets. So right now I think that they might be the sneaky favorites to land one of the big fish of the trade deadline market. I'd say the best names available right now are David Price from the Tampa Bay Rays, who is under contract this year and next year. So not only would you be trading for him for the stretch run this year, but also for a playoff opportunity next year. And, of course, he's one of the best 10 starters in the game. A battle-tested lefty who's pitches in the AL East, so you'd have to assume that any other division he goes to, he'll actually have a better statistics to go with his playoff tenacity and his bulldog mentality on the mound. And then I'd say the second-best player that's probably going to be available this trade season is Justin Marger from the Cubs. Yesterday, it was reported the Cubs offered him a 5-year, $85 million extension, which he declined. As a Cubs fan, I can tell you right now, I'd say after that declining of that contract extension, I'd say it's probably a 95% chance they trade him before the deadline. And he's a real interesting case because, as we talked about on the show before, you know, there's been a proliferation of arm injuries, especially Tommy John surgeries. And a lot of that's due to overuse of pitchers' arms, especially when they're younger in high school, college, et cetera. And what's interesting about Jeff Samarja is even though he's a little bit older at 29, he has such low mileage on his arm from primarily being a football player for so long. So, I mean, he's in terrific shape. I mean, if you're going to bet on a pitcher staying healthy for the next 3-4 years, there might not be a better bet in baseball than Jeff Samarja. He's really taken off this year and looked like at least a borderline ace. And I think he'll bring back the Cubs a real nice return. And right now I think that he could be the difference in a couple of divisions that are totally up for grabs. I'm thinking of the AL East, where everybody's within striking distance. If I was the Blue Jays or the Orioles or the Yankees or even the Red Sox, I'd be all over them trying to get them to come, especially knowing that it's probably unlikely that the Rays would trade David Price within the division. And then the same thing with the AL West. I think that DeMarzio makes a ton of sense for the Oakland A's, who have seen their rotation ravaged with injuries, the Anaheim Angels, who have a great offense but really little pitching, and maybe even the Texas Rangers, although injuries are really starting to catch up with them, so this might not be the best year for them to go all in. But I think it will be a real interesting next 6 weeks with a lot of trades, even though there's not too many teams that you would consider quote-unquote sellers at this point.
Okay. You know, just to wrap the show, I mean, we both really like Tony Gwynn. I mean, you know, none of us living in this area of the country were big Padres fan, but I think we can all agree that we enjoyed watching Tony Gwynn play baseball. His his methodical approach to hitting. I mean, the fact that he was a Gold Glove right fielder, that he didn't look like a pro athlete, but God, he was underratedly athletic for his size, and the guy just did something better than everybody else, which is hit the baseball. One of the softest spoken guys too. I mean, he's a real, you know, this term gets thrown around, but I mean, he was a real ambassador for the game because, you know, he was likable. He was super likable. He's super friendly looking. Always had a smile on his face. Played, you know, like all these cliches. He might be the definition of all of them, just because that's exactly what he was. I mean, he just like a kid, man. And then once he got out of it, once he retired from baseball, what did he do? He jumped right back into it and he coached baseball. So, I mean, it's very, very sad to lose a guy like that. You know, especially when there's, you know, a guy, people walking around that probably shouldn't be, and then to lose a guy that, by all accounts, was a great human being is just tragic in any form. What were your thoughts about Tony Gwynn growing up watching baseball?
I love Tony Gwynn, and I saw somebody else's idea, and you know, I'm totally going to steal it right now. I forgot who even put this out there, but you know, that hole between the third base and the shortstop is called the 5.5 hole, the 5.5 hole. They definitely need to rename that the Tony Gwynn hole, because he got so many singles through that way. You know, the thing that I love about him is that he just cared so much about baseball, just loved baseball and did everything he could to maximize his ability. He's known for being one of the first players to really start using video to his advantage. Of course, now every single player is constantly looking at video, but in the old, you know, even within the last 20 years, it was so uncommon to find guys looking at tape or looking at film. Instead, you know, they're totally going based on advanced scouting reports rather than looking at things for their own eyes. You know, he was just obsessed about hitting. Tim Kirkjian had a great story the other day where Tony was in the batting cages taking up bats against the pitching machine, and he had the pitching machine set to 50 miles an hour. And somebody else walked in there and goes, "Why do you have the pitching machine set so low?" And Gwynn responded, "Can you hit a fastball?" And the guy said, "Yes." And he goes, "Well, I can too." He goes, "But, you know, I'm trying to stay back and stay back for breaking balls so that I keep my weight balanced and go through it and go right back up the middle." And what he had was this little hole cut right behind the pitching machine, just big enough for a baseball to fit through. And while he was trying to stay back on the breaking balls, he was trying to hit the ball through that little hole. And as soon as he replied that way to the guy, a fellow player, the very next pitch comes through, and wouldn't you know it, Tony Gwynn puts it right through that little hole, and all the player could do was shake his head and leave the room just thinking, you know what, that's greatness right there. And like you said, he was such a great guy, and you know, Theo Epstein came, the current president sort of the GM for the Cubs. And he came up with the San Diego Padres in the mid-90s, and he said the most welcoming member of the organization for just a little piss-on intern was Tony Gwynn. And he said, sometimes you hear stories about how great someone is, and, you know, sometimes the truth can be exaggerated a little bit, but he said it was 100% accurate for Tony Gwynn. And you know, we've heard that time and time again over the past few days of old clubhouse attendants and trainers and other guys that no one would ever ever even thinks about when they think of Major League Baseball teams. And Gwynn used to be just an outstanding tipper and would teach their kids how to hit and give them hitting tips and do this and that. And, you know, he just seemed like one of those guys that you would beg, borrow, and steal to get on your team, get in your clubhouse, and get around your young players in the locker room.
Yeah, I mean, everything you just said was dead on, and it was, you know, he was a guy that, you know, we really could have happy to keep around for the next 30 to 40 years.
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
we see so many guys strike out now where it's just second nature, where we don't even shudder at someone with 130, 150, 175 Ks. And Tony Gwynn just despised the strikeout, and you know, I kind of wish more guys would take that approach instead of always trying to swing for the fences, because you know what? You put the ball in play, you never know what can happen. A guy can boot the ball, it can find a hole. I mean, that's how baseball is funny. You can hit a line drive right at somebody and make an out, and the next to bat, you can get it off the end of the bat, and that loop single finds a hole out in the outfield, and you get a base hit. I just wish more guys would kind of adapt that approach of doing whatever it takes to not strike out. I mean, the guy came up to bat 129 times combined against Greg Maddux and Pedro Martinez, you know, inarguably two of the best 10 pitchers in baseball history, two future Hall of Famers, guys that have 6,500 combined strikeouts in their career, and he struck out zero. Let me repeat that. Zero times against those two. I mean,
that's
that
amazing,
not,
actually.
Just unbelievable.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's just unbelievable. So, I mean, that's the type of hitter he was, always paired, and was just going to do whatever it took to get on base and help the team win.
Yeah, and another stat that was kind of amazing, and I saw the same Tim Kirchen thing, is that he never struck out more than 40 times in a season. And Tim Kirchen said something like there's a handful of players that have done that, that did that in the month of May, which was kind of incredible. Like that is incredible. And I'm actually looking at his stats right now. Yeah, in that year he only played 133 games that year. I mean, he had 521 at bats and struck out 40 times. And that was in 1988. And then he's also the guy that switched to the smaller, shorter bat too, which you don't really see. People are always going for the longer ones, not necessarily the heavy ones, but you know. And it was just kind of, he just knew he can get it around, you know, that much quicker, and it helped him. So,
right.
I mean, he's the smartest hitter. And oh yeah, the other thing Tim Kirchen that thing pointed out was the strike shortened year. He was hitting .394 and you know, flirting with that 400 mark, that you know, the ever-elusive 400 batting average. And, I mean, there's a lot of people who think that he might have gotten it or at least come the closest of anyone in recent memory.
Yeah, and that might be, especially with the propensity of defensive shifts and the advanced metrics in defense where, you know, more and more teams are putting guys where the ball most often goes. I think that's going to be the closest we'll ever see again to somebody hitting 400. And, you know, Buster Olney kind of said the same thing, that he is 100% confident that as well as the Montreal Expos and their terrific team that year is the two, you know, biggest travesties of the 1994 season, because he thinks without a doubt Tony Gwynn would have hit 400 that year because he was just so locked in at the plate. And, you know, that's really sad that we never got to know whether or not he would get there. And, you know, you're talking about his bats. I mean, this guy was so obsessed and wanting to do his best at the plate and be the best hitter he could be that he actually went and picked out the wood for those bats because he wanted to make sure that he was going to get the best piece of lumber possible. And if you can't respect that, I don't know what you can respect.
No, I'm with you 100%. And I also love the fact that he stole over 30 bases one, two, three, four times in his career. 56 bases in one season. I mean, that's for a guy his size. That's incredible. 56 bases while hitting .370, and he wasn't a power guy. But I mean, there was a year. What am I looking at? 1997, where he hit 119 RBI. It's kind of nuts, you know, considering that he only had 17 home runs that year. The guy just, you know, just hit baseball. He did it better than anybody.
And he played in some pitcher's parks and. You know, like you said, the fact that he stole so many bases despite looking like my left fielder in beer league softball last night is really, really a testament to what a underrated athlete he was. I think sometimes he gets miscast as just a hitter, But he was a really solid defender in the outfield as well, where, you know, you need good speed, you need good instincts, you have to have a good arm, and he had all three of those things.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, he'll be missed, absolutely. But yeah, you guys are under the hood. These are Bill Kegel and Brian Shipley. Brian, any parting thoughts?
Well, you know, I'm looking forward to the NBA draft next week. You know, I feel bad for the Kansas center Embiid, who seemingly might have might fall a few spots, especially if he turns out that he does have a stress fracture in his foot. But, you know, someone else's loss can be somebody's treasure, and I think that if he somehow falls out of the top four or five picks in 5 years, we're going to look back and look at him as the steal of the draft.
Yeah, I agree. I couldn't agree more, actually. Yes, I mean, you know what, maybe we can maybe we'll do a show live during the first couple of picks next week. See if we can talk to the powers that be and get that worked out. So, I'll send something out on Facebook about that. But all right, Brian. Well, hey, it was good talking to you, man, and I look forward to talking to you, and hopefully we can get Mike on next week. If not, maybe we can get a third special guest. But everybody follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and download the show on iTunes, and don't forget to tell a friend.
Sounds good. Thanks, Bill.
All right. Take care, Brian.
Take care.